You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with the author Stuart Onan. Stuart Onan's award-winning fiction includes Snow Angels, A Prayer for the Dying, Last Night at the Lobster, and Emily Alone. Granta named him one of America's best young novelists. He lives in Pittsburgh. When I spoke to him last week, we discussed his latest book, The Odds, A Love Story, which was published by Viking. The Odds takes place on Valentine's weekend as Art and Marion Fowler flee their Cleveland suburb for Niagara Falls, desperate to recoup their losses. Jobless, with their home approaching foreclosure and their marriage on the brink of collapse, Art and Marion liquidate their savings account and book a bridal suite at the Falls' ritziest casino for a second honeymoon. While they sightsee like tourists during the day, at night they risk it all at the roulette wheel to try and fix their finances and save their marriage. A tender yet honest exploration of faith, forgiveness, and last chances, The Odds is a reminder that love, like life, is always a gamble. When I spoke to Stuart Onan, I first asked him what had inspired him to write The Odds, A Love Story.
Well, I just finished a book called Emily Alone, which is about one woman living by herself in her late 70s. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write something that was a little more interactive, because that book was very much a lot of, you know, one-person scenes over and over. So I wanted people that were sort of in conflict and together all the time. And so I was thinking, you know, a place where people are always together is on vacation. There's no escape when you're on vacation. And I started thinking about writing about a marriage, because, you know, that's always sort of fertile ground, I think. And I'm not exactly sure how it came to be, but I knew that it was going to come down to this kind of bet. This kind of, you know, putting everything down, putting everything on the table and risking everything, which is kind of what I think romance or marriage is about. And so I just had this idea in my mind, the bet. It was always going to be about the bet. And eventually I came up with Art and Marion, the married couple, and sent them off to Niagara Falls. Because where's a better place to bet on marriage than Niagara Falls?
Exactly. Do you spend time in Niagara Falls? Have you been there much?
I've been there a little bit over the years, but while I was writing this book, I ended up going there twice. Once during the summer, and then once again, actually over Valentine's Day weekend with my wife.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, really tempting fate there. and we ended up, you know, staying in the same hotel that they do and doing everything, because I just wanted to sort of get the feel of everything.
Yeah. Well, there was definitely the feel of your having been there to write this. I mean, just some of the moments where they're trying to look out the windows when they're in that viewing area and it's, you know, kind of iced up and everything. That was just really clear that you'd spent some time researching what it's like in the winter. I really enjoyed, you talk about how they you knew from the start that they were going to bet it all, and I enjoyed how the idea of what was all sort of changed throughout the novel. You know, it was like their idea of what they needed really changed. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I think, or I hope that usually happens. I always think I'm going to be writing about one thing, but actually when I get to know the characters better and better, it turns into something else, completely something else. But like you say, that they feel that they really, really need, that they have to address. And in the course of the pressure that's on them during the book always sort of brings that out of them.
Right. And in most books, maybe it's not quite as clearly placed on the page as in a book where a single bet is going to have so much importance. Do you agree with that? You know what I mean? It's just like the idea of that big bet, as the book goes on, it becomes more and less important in different ways.
Well, I mean, it is, when we begin, that's sort of the framework of this weekend and their mission there. But as it goes on, and in fact, that we're actually writing and talking about something completely, completely different, which is about how well we know one another and what we give one another in a marriage or in a romance.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I did this sort of the same sort of thing I think, in Songs for the Missing, where the framework is this teenage girl goes missing. But as we go through the process of the book, what we're really looking at is how well we know one another, or the pain of not knowing one another, even if we prevent ourselves from being known.
Mm-hmm.
There. So there's always something, I hope, that's the hope, that as you're working on it, something deeper or fuller will emerge and take precedence there and mean something to the reader.
Yeah. One of the things that I loved about The Odds is that Marion's and Art's personalities are so well represented in the ways that they approach this weekend. And their personalities are so well represented for us by how they feel about going away for the weekend, going to Niagara Falls, revisiting where they've been before, and placing this bet. Art is somebody who's very meticulous. He's got a financial background, you know, and he's very, the way that he wants to approach the gambling aspect is very set in stone. He's got this method that he's researched that he wants to use. And Marianne's so much more, she just wants to kind of like throw her chips all over the table and have more fun with it, or just be a little looser with it. And I thought that was a great way to show us who each of them is.
And they've been like that forever. I mean, the opposite detract in a way. I mean, Art has always been a numbers guy. I mean, he's the math whiz when he's a kid. And, you know, he's always worried that things aren't going to turn out the way that he wants them to. Whereas Marion, I mean, she's just sort of easier going. She's better with people, you know. But she doesn't really know her own heart very well.
Mm-hmm.
There, whereas Art knows his, and it's all in one direction, which is directly at her, which is not easy to take.
Right, right.
For Marion, because Marion's like, oh my God, I'm so tired of this. you know, it's been 30 years.
There. Right.
And she doesn't, I mean, even going into this weekend, she doesn't really know her heart very well.
Mm-hmm.
There. What does she really need? What can she really do? And she's had this vision, perhaps, of leaving the marriage and living on her own, but it never gets beyond sort of this little dreamy stage there.
Right.
And as we get closer and closer to actually putting the money on the table, to actually making the decision, making the jump, she turns out to be even less romantic than Art, in a way.
I think this is really important to good novels, and yours always do this so well, and that is just sort of putting your characters into really complicated situations and putting the plot through complicated situations in a way. You know, for example, they go away on this mad last-ditch effort to save their relationship, and where do they go? They go to the place where so many relationships start, or marriages start, you know, Niagara Falls, which is just like the epitome of the romantic vacation.
And where they've been before, remember, they actually honeymooned there, so there are all these sort of ghosts of the past and all the decisions that they made that didn't quite pan out. So from the very beginning, I think they're great characters in that they're on high alert from the very beginning. Emotionally, they're on high alert from in the present. They're on high alert sort of from the past, and they're kind of looking toward anxiously toward this future that may or may not be.
And it's so amazing when they see other couples that are just getting married, you know, this weekend. Their ideas about what will happen to those people are so fraught with their own baggage, and it's really interesting.
And they're inescapable because it's Valentine's Day in Niagara Falls. So everywhere they turn, they're faced with their own past, their possible future. I mean, and it's like you say, fraught. It's all around them. It's, you know, absolutely charged. And I love that about the setting in this, because at first I thought, oh, it's just kind of this ready-made, bland, kind of average, boring setting. But once I got into it, I was like, oh my gosh, look at all these opportunities.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't been to Niagara Falls since I was a very young child, so I think it must have changed hugely. I mean, there never used to be casinos there, and now it sounds like they've got the Wax Museum and all these tourist destinations, and it was fun to read about. I totally felt like I could see it, even though clearly it's very different than when I was last there.
You know, it may not really be that different, because remember, I mean, the main attraction is the falls themselves.
Right.
And the falls, I mean, they never change. They're eternal. And that was the great thing. It's the flip side of the metaphor of Niagara Falls is, yes, there's all this tacky, junky crap along the sides, but elementally it's about the power of this water.
Yeah.
And this moving water. And it's a really nice metaphor for love, I guess. I mean, the motive force for most of our happiness.
Yeah. Stuart, I'm wondering, maybe this would be a good time for you to read a couple pages from The Odds.
Okay. Well, I'm going to actually read a love scene.
Okay, great.
And each section is prefaced by the odds of something. And this is the odds of the sun coming up, one in one. The next morning, as if to erase the night before, they made love. He was tentative yet pesky, rubbing against her. She was barely awake. "Seriously," she said, since his excitement had nothing to do with her, but gave in, sleepily hiking up her nightgown. "Try not to press too hard on my stomach." "I won't," he promised, then paid too much attention to honoring the request, locking his elbows so he hovered above her. The bed was less giving than their pillow top at home, and his wrists hurt. It had been so long, he was afraid he would explode, and proceeded slowly. The heat of her always astonished him, as if deep inside, like the earth, she possessed a fiery core. He was quiet, deliberate, focused on her forehead, her eyebrows, the hollows of her collarbone. She tipped her chin up, and he descended to kiss her throat. His breath was sour, and she turned her head to one side, closed her eyes as if to steal a few more minutes of sleep, murmuring with pleasure to encourage him. His lips on her neck stirred ticklish beginnings. Too soon, he pulled away from her throat, but she wasn't invested enough to correct him. She peeked and found him working intently, his face slightly pained, as if he had a toothache. As he quickened, she urged, squeezing her arms against her ribs to push her breasts together, a trick that never failed. He seized, clenched, then exhaled, let his head drop. They chastely kissed, politely traded their most solemn pledge, perilous any other time, yet exempt here, as if this space were sacred, staying together till she patted his side to let him know he could roll off now. Their room faced east, and the curtains were edged with light. "Looks like it's going to be a nice day," he said. "I thought it already was," she said.
Thank you very much for reading that. That's a wonderful scene.
Thanks.
So that's Stuart O'Nan reading from The Odds, which is published by Viking. You know, I think there's a craft, a real craft to writing scenes about sex. And, you know, I think mostly in books, the scenes that you read about sex are about great sex, and they're always about the best sex you can have. But, you know, I loved that Marion and Art are having real sex, you know? And actually, there's another scene in the book where they're having, you know, sort of not great sex. And I wondered if you can just talk a little bit about writing, you know, just kind of real sex scenes.
Well, in this case, I've got a couple that's been married for 30 years, so that the discovery part of it is sort of over. It's like, oh my God, I'm actually having sex. You know, these people are in their 50s. So yes, they've been having sex for a long, long time.
Right.
But in this case, because the relationship is not going well, every time that they become intimate with one another, whether it's having sex or whether it's just talking, there are things in the way. Their memories, their problems, and so nothing is simple. Everything is very, very complex.
Mm-hmm.
For both of them, they're both very aware of what this means to their relationship. And so when you're working in two points of view, the his and her, the he said, she said point of view, you can see how they're feeling about things. And the disparity between the way each of them sees what's going on is always enlightening. And can sometimes be sort of queasily funny,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Because
it's a very uncomfortable book in a way, especially for people who've been married a long time, because I think they tend to see themselves in the characters and go, oh yeah, I know how that is. it's a great reaction to get from readers. But in this case, it can be a little, it can be a little dicey.
Yeah.
Every scene like that where you have your major characters on stage together in a very dramatic situation, it's a great opportunity. It's a wonderful opportunity to take advantage of it as much as possible. And again, because of the situation, Niagara Falls, Valentine's Day, they're in the bridal suite. They're going to make love. There's no way around it. And you know, for Marion, it's like, oh, how do I do this and still maintain my honesty?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for Art, it's like, you know, how can I possibly win her over after having been with her for 30 years and having failed her?
Right.
So, I mean, they bring all their history to the scenes. Now, I think that's usually the difficulty with any scene, you know, any scene at all, is the expectations the characters bring into the scene. And we have to feel those expectations as we go into the scene.
Yeah.
And if we feel them and we see them sort of falling short of those expectations or, you know, overcoming it and doing better than their expectations, then we're really there with the characters. But I think for a lot of people when they write sex scenes, somehow we're not really within the characters. We're usually too far away from them. Okay. So there's no intimacy there.
Yeah. What you said a second ago about both of them being in the scene and what a great opportunity that is for a writer, I also think that this book in particular is really interesting because you have created a novel that has, I would call it, close third-person perspectives. You know, their points of view are both very clearly on the page. But you also are comfortable to move back and forth between their points of view within a scene, which isn't always the way that that happens. And I just wondered if you could talk about deciding to do that.
In the old days, that's how people wrote. I mean, the book is set up omnisciently from the beginning, where we establish omniscience in the first page there with that sort of overview of the marriage, and then we bring the reader down into the bus and into the people there. Mm-hmm. But in the old days, I mean, the Victorian narrator could go into anyone's mind at any time. And I think for irony's sake, especially during conversations, I think you have to establish and then sort of preserve the right to do that throughout the book there. Mm-hmm. And in this, because I know that sometimes what one person says to the other person is going to react very negatively to it, even though they don't sort of visually react with gesture.
Right.
They'll react in the mind there, thinking, oh no, not again. I think I knew because I had basically these two heads I had to get into, that I wanted, to be able to do that. And I would set it up early on by going omniscient again, because it is, in a way, it is kind of a modern fairy tale.
Right.
In a way. So I wanted that teller, the figure of the teller, to be there at the beginning and at the end and occasionally throughout.
Yeah.
There. So there is a little bit more distance sometimes in the third-person omniscient summary narration, occasionally. But, again, what's so great about the omniscient narrator is that it can go closer and move further and further into the character and really shorten that psychic distance till we're all the way inside of them.
Yeah.
If we want to. Omniscient can take on what third subjective, that sort of intimate or close third subjective, can do. But again, it reserves the right to sort of bounce outside as well. It's very flexible, and I think the old third omniscient we think of is very heavy-handed. We feel the hand of the author all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you're in third sort of subjective and you're close, it's a very light hand because you feel, oh, the character is directing everything,
yeah,
even though you're writing in the third person.
Okay.
So that's what I kind of wanted to do. I wanted to sort of use that the third omniscience, but very, very light, early and late, and a little bit in the middle. But,
yeah,
but again, intimacy, sticking close and then having the characters feel like they're real. I mean, that's the most important thing, even though this is kind of a fairy tale.
You mentioned a little while ago when you started your reading that you start each of the sections of the book with the odds of something relevant to what's about to come in Art and Marion's story. So I'm wondering how you had the idea to do that. It was great. I loved it. They were really interesting. And also, were they real odds, and did you research them?
Well, I had been doing research on the odds because after a while I knew early on in the writing the book was going to be called The Odds.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to sort of obsess about odds, and I'd look things up, and I'd interloan books from the library and pull out odds of different things happening just because I thought it was kind of neat to think about life in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
And art being part of the insurance business, that idea of the actuarial tables, or what are the possibilities for people, mm-hmm, at a certain age and all that. I compiled all these lists of the different odds, and then I was thinking, how do I get these in the book? You can't really do it through one of the characters because then it feels like exposition's kind of just shoved in there.
Right.
And I'm not sure how I came across it, but I thought of the 19th century tradition of, at the beginning of the chapter, it's chapter one, in which I am eaten by bears. even before you get into the chapter, like, oh my gosh, bears are going to eat this guy. Oh, I want to see that. So it's a way of drawing the reader into the section and giving them, again, that expectation of what might or might not happen,
right,
in the chapter. So I think it actually speeds the process, and it's kind of fun. And I wanted the book to be a little more fun because so much in the book is kind of tough, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of mixed emotions in the book. So
yeah.
I wanted something that was just straight out fun. As for the odds in there, there are a few of them that I just made up on my own there,
right,
which, again, fun.
Well, do you mind if I read a paragraph?
Oh, go ahead.
From the book? Okay. So this is a paragraph that describes Marion watching the falls. Here, hard by the rushing current, with a view of the rapids upstream, she could appreciate this wasn't just a river, but a whole great lake pouring over a cliff. Feet from the edge, gulls stood on rocks as white caps surged past. The blue water turned sea green like the curl of a wave, broke and flew, foaming in overlapping sheets as it fell away, constantly, endlessly. She'd forgotten the raw force of it, the exhilarating danger, the reason they were all there. I loved that. And you know, the funny thing is, as I read that, I realized I had forgotten the raw force of it. And Niagara Falls is just so amazing. So I bring this up, first of all, because I just thought that was a gorgeous section, and I loved the description of the falls. But I also wanted to ask you, if in writing the book and revising the book, you found yourself trying to be careful about how much you let the falls act as a metaphor within the story. It is a great metaphor for, you know, the danger that, you know, the reason that they're there is the danger, the exhilaration, as you've already said, love. But anyway, so do you mind talking about that a little bit?
Well, I mean, I knew that it was, when I first thought of using it, it was a ready-made stage, and it had so many connotations that go along with Niagara Falls.
Mm-hmm.
The most important of which, I think, is that idea of risk or danger.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get that if I'd sent them to, say, Vegas, or if I'd sent them to casinos over in Connecticut, you wouldn't have, or Atlantic City, you wouldn't have felt that at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted that idea of risk or danger being sort of echoed in the natural world there in the setting.
Mm-hmm.
And also that idea of the artificial world of the casino, in which, you know, you're stuck and it's timeless and there's nothing going on there except for the stupid gambling. and yet, you know, a block away, here's one of the wonders of the world that people have traveled halfway across the world just to see, and instead you're inside, you know,
right,
messing around with some plastic chips on a table.
Right.
And that difference between commerce, right, or money, or all that, money being happiness, versus sort of the thrill of nature and the natural world. I mean, mm-hmm. when Marion's standing there watching that, it's obviously a metaphor for romantic love,
mm-hmm.
in a way. You know, the thrill, the danger, the exhilaration of romantic love. So it was kind of set that way, and I didn't worry too much about it being an overbearing symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, everyone understands that it is already, and that it is also a real place. So
mm-hmm.
I figured it's natural that people would go there on Valentine's Day, and as long as they do what's natural and I don't have to sort of twist anything, then I'll be fine. I just mm-hmm. I'll get into them, the characters, and let them react to things, and I should be good.
Yeah, yeah.
And let the metaphors pile up, and the obvious metaphors pile up, and because, I mean, they're everywhere. They're in the same elevator going down behind the falls. And the tour guide says, you're standing where John F. Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe stood. what could stand in, or and Princess Di, what could stand in worse for sort of doomed love or doomed marriage and all that? So, and you don't have to say anything. You don't have to say a word about it. You're like, oh, my God, JFK, Marilyn Monroe, and Princess Di. This is where you're standing, and you're going down in an elevator.
Right. Yeah. So maybe that's how you keep the metaphor from being too heavy-handed, is you don't do anything other than just, like, state the facts.
and say, there it is.
There it is.
And you know, being true to, you know, what actually happens there. You know, like in the winter, you know, the windows fill up with ice.
Right. Exactly. That was great. I appreciated that you reminded me that when the television broadcast used to go off the air at night, the Star Spangled Banner would come on, and then they would play that montage of, I can't remember if it was photographs or video clips, including Niagara Falls. That was so much fun to remember. It seems like 1,000 years ago.
I know. And it is 1,000 years ago. And again, it points up, you know, where these two have come from.
Yeah.
You know, they don't belong in this world, and in a way, they don't belong in this world anymore. They've kind of outlived it in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask you about the. I don't want to get too specific and give away too much of your plot, but I will say that each of them, Art and Marion, has misbehaved in one way or another in their marriage. They've failed each other, and they've failed the marriage. And although you do let the reader know about that history, you don't really dwell there. You don't make their history a huge subplot. And I just I wondered if that was something that you were very conscious of as you wrote the book, not creating a huge story around the history of their failed marriage or you know, possibly failing marriage.
Well there's a subtext there always. And that comes from, I think, you know, first Art deciding to go outside of the marriage,
mm-hmm.
And then Marion deciding to sort of fight to win him back, but then not quite knowing what to do with him once she got him back.
Yeah, right.
And then holding it against him as well. And I think it's a more common thing than people think.
Yeah.
And again, you know, they've both acted sort of, I guess, badly in the marriage, and yet it seems that they have been committed to the marriage over the years here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I had set them up as a couple that had never gone outside of marriage after 30 years, they'd be a rather dull couple.
Yeah.
I mean, they're dull enough as it is.
I guess what I mean is, that, okay, so he went outside the marriage, but you don't give us full-on scenes with Wendy and, you know, the flashbacks into that whole time of his life. It's much more sort of presented to us as just like, this is what was. And,
right,
and,
right. I mean, it's done, it's over. It has been over for a long time. I mean, it pops up from time to time, but just sort of hints.
Mm-hmm.
Hints of it, little tastes of it here and there that always they spur him into sort of more guilt and trying to work harder to make the marriage work now, even though it's impossible because of what he did 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a classic kind of instance. You know, the thing that you cannot or will not be forgiven for.
Right.
No matter what you do.
Yeah. Your descriptions are so spot on. They're just so perfect. Through all of your books, I've always enjoyed, there are always moments where I just feel incredible understanding of what you're presenting, even if I might not have remembered it 5 minutes before. And I said a minute ago, you know, you have this great description of these people playing at the slot machines, and the impromptu electronic choruses of Camptown Races and La Cucaracha and the Yellow Rose of Texas. And anyway, I won't read that whole paragraph, but, I sort of imagine you walking through the world with a notebook. Is that what you do? I mean, are you constantly taking notes when you're thinking about writing a scene?
Well, I'll do legwork. I'll actually go to places that I'm going to set something. I do, you know, location scouting like the movies do,
mm-hmm.
and see what's going on there. I mean, if I had written the casino stuff from memory, I would have had them using, you know, coins or tokens, which nobody uses anymore.
Yeah, that was surprising.
Yeah, I wanted to be absolutely sort of current at it. So I actually, you know, got off my butt and went to the casinos and looked at people and watched them, and, you know, which is hard because, you know, when I go to the casino, I like to put money on the table.
Yeah.
But so I was like, nope, you're just going to go and take notes and look at things. And, you know, I got a lot of good stuff there. A lot of it never gets actually into the books. But knowing that you have stuff that you can use is a good feeling.
Mm-hmm. Are you a roulette player? Is that your favorite game, or was that just Art's?
Yeah. No, that is my favorite game. I'm a bad roulette player, a very bad one. I get excited. I start chasing numbers. I think, oh, 31's got to come up. You know, it hasn't come up the last, you know, 12 times. It's got to come up, and I get very nervous. And yeah, it's bad. So yeah, I guess I was sort of using that too.
Yeah,
write what you know.
Okay, so at one point, Art and Marion go to a Heart concert, and I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about writing descriptions of music, you know, either music that we've all heard, like Heart, or in other of your works, if you've ever written about fictional music, describing music that you're actually sort of inventing on the page.
Yeah, really tough, really hard to write about music. I mean, it's easy to kind of plug music in and say that they were listening to My Funny Valentine by a jazz trio. I mean, everyone can come up with something there. Everyone can sort of fill that in. So you can't sort of face it or approach it kind of head on. There's no way to do that and make it come across.
Mm-hmm.
So it's best to be atmospheric and give basically the feeling of what it's like to be there at the concert more than actually trying to do the songs.
Mm-hmm.
I try to do a little bit here and there with a few riffs, but again, these are riffs that people already kind of know. I mean, you know the riff from Barracuda, or most people do.
Right.
So you can write about that, and you're on some sort of common ground. But to try to sort of, you know, build a song out of words would be almost an impossible task.
Now, are you a musician?
I was in a band, but I sang. I didn't play an instrument.
Okay.
I was in a punk band back in the 70s.
Okay.
In Pittsburgh. So I love music, and I love all sort of all kinds of music. So there's always some kind of soundtrack to each of the books.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, you know, Valentine's Day at the casino, it just made sense that Heart would be there.
Yeah.
you know, and how heart has changed over the years from, you know, the two beautiful Wilson sisters to, you know, this semi-nostalgic. And in fact, they're coming to Pittsburgh this summer.
Have you seen them?
No, I've never seen them. Seen them ever. So I'm not going to be in town, though. I'm going to be up in New England watching the Red Sox.
Okay. What I really enjoyed about the Heart scene, actually, I thought you did a great job of describing their music, which, of course, we have heard, so perhaps that makes it easier. But the dancing, Art and Marion dancing to the music, it was so awesome. They're so self-conscious. He certainly knows that he doesn't look very good. And it's just
he's worried about how he's going to look there, you know, among, you know, literally, you know, 1,000 people that are just like him, you know.
Yeah.
He's definitely there with his people, but he still feels sort of odd and... Yeah. Whereas Marion is, you know, she's drunk and hammered, and she's just having a good time.
She's just having
fun. It's funny because he's the one that actually likes Heart.
Mm-hmm.
Marion really doesn't like Heart at all. They're only going because he thinks that she liked them when she was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And then there they are at the concert, and she gets into it, and he doesn't.
Right.
Typical of their personalities.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's sort of choreographing how great things will be. And then he has a hard time relaxing and enjoying the fruits of his labor, you know? So.
The reality of it somehow eludes him.
Yeah.
There.
Exactly.
He's sort of built up with expectation or.
I'm curious if you knew how the book would end as you worked on it. Did you know ahead of time where this was going?
Well, it's obviously it has to end with him going back to Cleveland. I mean, there's no way around that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like all of a sudden one of them's going to go, well, I'm going to stay here in Canada forever. So it comes down to, you know, do they win? Does Art's plan at the table work, or do they lose? And then what does that mean to the marriage?
Right.
There. And so from the beginning, I was thinking of, I would then, after they win and or lose, then there's a section that involves them going back to Cleveland and carrying on with their lives and which way they go.
Yeah.
Do they stay together? Do they break apart? And if so, is that the best thing for them? And it always came back to how would they look back upon this weekend, you know, 20 years from now? Would they look back and think, oh, this was a good thing, or oh, this was a bad thing, or do I feel sorry for this, you know? And so there was going to be a big, long sort of, you know, epilogue-like section involving a lot of summary narration that was going to cover 20 years
mm-hmm.
of time. And then I realized, and Jonathan Leeson told me this the other you know, a few years ago about a book that I was writing. I showed him the manuscript. He goes, you know, it wants to be a poem. You know, it wants to be fast. It doesn't want to linger. It wants to hit it and quit it. And I sort of took that advice to heart in this one, which is, you know, if you get to the right point, if you hit that right note, you don't need anything else.
Yeah.
But it was surprising. As I was writing, I was like, oh, my God, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, that one, that's what happened. And two, that's all I have to say.
That's it.
I don't need to say anything else. It's a weird, it's almost like a, what's the word, that freeze frame ending. You know, the old bad cliched freeze frame endings from like the 70s, you know, cheapo action movies or horror movies.
Right.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. But I realized, wow, I mean, that's exactly it. So to me, it was totally surprising and also inevitable and right.
Mm-hmm.
And once I realized that, I thought, well, for the reader, for most readers, I hope it will also have that same effect. I hope. But no, I mean, I had some sense, but I wasn't quite sure until I got there as to what would happen. Then I got there and I realized, oh, well, this other stuff doesn't have to happen.
Yeah, which is a relief.
it's typical because, you know, usually you make all these plans, and if you just follow the plan, then you really haven't gone anywhere.
Right.
You know, but if something jumps up and sort of takes you a completely different way, then I think you know you've got something going on.
Mm-hmm. You've published so many novels and other books too, not just novels. And I'm wondering what your writing schedule is like, and do you work on multiple projects at the same time?
Well, actually, I'm a very slow writer. I'm a very
Are you?
Sort of plodding, extremely slow. I try to write one page a day, double space, so that's about 300 words.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a lot, but you know, if you do it steadily, it begins to pile up.
So you write like Art gambles.
Yeah. yeah, there you go. I'm very, very deliberate, and I try to work from 9 to 5. I don't have another job at this point. So I have the privilege of writing as if I have all the time in the world, which is, mm-hmm. that's what they always tell you to write like you have all the time in the world. And in this case, I try to take that to heart and, you know, one page a day. It may be good, it may be crummy. Some days you think you're working really well and you look at it later that night and you're like, ooh, this is not going to stand. Mm-hmm. Other times, so you're going along and just line by line and fighting it the whole way and you're like, oh, it's a tough day. And then you look at it and say, hey, that's actually pretty good. So you never quite know what you're going to get. You try to be steady, put those working days together, you know, just line them up one by one by one. Put your time in there at the desk, Flannery O'Connor. Sit at your machine, she said.
Right.
That's exactly it. Sit at your machine. I'd much rather be reading. You know, I'd much rather get up from my chair and read, you know, pick a book off the shelf and sit down with it and read for an hour. But, you know, no one's going to write it except you, so.
Yeah. So is it literally that one page? I mean, you're not working on yesterday's page a little bit and then maybe a little bit of tomorrow's page? Or are you pretty routine-oriented as far as...
No, I mean, I'm very routine, very, very routine. I mean, very compulsive that way, obsessive. And, you know, if I get a little bit more than one page, that's great. If I get two pages, hey, that's wonderful. But, again, there's no guarantee that it's going to hold up.
Yeah.
And after I've finished it, later, you know, after dinner, I'll sit down with those pages that I wrote today, and I'll, you know, I'll correct them, and I'll make changes to them. And then later I'll read. The reading is always somehow directed. I always read something that's going to sort of feed the writing there.
Oh, okay.
And I'll take notes on what I've been reading and see how that might play into, you know, the next day's writing. Then you wake up, you know, you sit down, you start putting in the changes from last night, and that gives you a little bit of juice, gives you a little flow of momentum. You start moving things around on the page, you start moving things, you know, and you say, okay, what scene am I in? What's my character up to? And you just try to move it forward a little. When I was working as an engineer, I didn't have really a lot of time to write, so I'd bring my manuscript with me to work, and I'd tell myself, if I can write one sentence today, you know, just one sentence, move the story along by one sentence, and that's sort of always been my way. That's kind of how I sort of taught myself to write, just keep it moving. You know, push that peanut across the desert with your nose. You can do it. Little by little, just be patient. You know, stay close to your character. You know, absorb their mood. You know, if you got mood and you got direction, you're going to do something good. Just got to keep at it.
Great. So I'm curious what you're working on now. What are you writing these days?
I'm actually doing research right now. I'm going to be writing a historical novel, I hope, Knockwood. and it's set in Los Angeles in the late 30s. So I'm trying to sort of, you know, get all that mood and tone and setting down there.
Yeah. So have you watched Roger Rabbit recently?
You know, actually, I've been thinking a lot about Roger Rabbit, which is very strange. I just reread all of Chandler. You know, and just sort of getting into that sort of semi-noirish mood. I don't know if I'm going to actually use any of that, but it's good to have.
Yeah.
Again, have sort of something to sort of base it on so you feel... You know, I'm not from Los Angeles. I've never lived in Los Angeles. So I may end up having to go out there and spend a little time, and you know, and I've got a French translator out there. He translated The Speed Queen, and he's like a 40s and 50s kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'll eat at like all the dives. He'll drink at the dive bars. He'll eat at like the old diners from, you know, the cafeteria style diners from way, way back. So I may have to go out there and hang around with him for a little while. And, you know, show me the bones of old L.A.
Right. Now, have your books taken place in L.A. before? Did Speed Queen end up in L.A.? I know they kind of traveled. But,
no, they never made it out to Santa Monica Pier, no. They never got to the end of Route 66.
Okay.
They got stopped halfway through with...
I couldn't remember where that happened, right?
Yeah. No, I don't think I've ever said anything. I said something in San Diego in, I think it was A World Away, my World War II novel.
Okay.
Dorothy lives in San Diego for a while. They're working at Consolidated Aircraft. So, you know, I've touched the West Coast a little bit. But I've never said something there sort of fully. So it's going to be a challenge. I mean, but you always want to write that book that's a little bit impossible to do. So.
Yeah. Now, okay, so you said when you're writing, you like to read works that will feed your writing. So are you reading anything that's for fun? Or
All research at this point. All research.
Okay.
I'm looking through a lot of LA histories, again, Chandler and sort of noir, looking at the noir era in Hollywood. That's about all I should divulge, really, because I haven't read a single word of it, so God knows.
Okay, so that's so that. But all of your reading will revolve around your research while you're doing research. You're not going to, like, break out in the evenings and pick up the latest by somebody else.
Probably not.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I get enough of that stuff anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, there may be room for some fun reading here and there, but usually when I sort of, you know, get interested in the subject, I really sort of, like, I overdo the research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just do way, way too much of it. And most of it, you know, 99% of it won't even affect the book at all. But I like to sort of totally indulge my curiosity. My wife says, I only write the book so I can do the research. Yeah, and that's probably true.
Right. Although understanding your subject really well will help you pick out the 10% that you'll use or whatever, probably.
Well, finally, for me, and usually in the way that I write, usually it's about character. Usually it's about knowing that character better than you can know anybody in real life.
Mm-hmm.
So that whatever comes up, you know, in the course of the story, you know how that character is going to react. And the reader will then go, oh, yeah, that's exactly how that character would react, because that's who that is.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to establish that intimacy with your character before you try to establish it with the reader in the character.
Mm-hmm.
Stay close.
Great. I wanted to just read a couple of lines from The Odds, if I could. One of them is from Marion's perspective. Why did it annoy her that he would do anything to please her? I love that line. And then this is less vital to their relationship, but in a similar way, I loved this. Art is watching the Olympics, and it says, he cared nothing for cross-country skiing, lanky Scandinavians in bodysuits following doggedly in one another's tracks, but quickly found he was rooting out of some warped principle for the leader to fall. So, for writers, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about making your characters more interesting through internal conflict.
Well, in both cases, these are things that the characters don't understand why they feel this way.
Mm-hmm.
They feel this way, but they don't know why, and they can't quite figure it out. And that's to me is always the most fascinating thing about character. What's indelible about them? What bothers them? Usually about themselves there, because then they'll bring those flaws out into the world and try to deal with them there. How do you do that? Just by being close to them, I think. Just by, you know, by getting intimate with them and following them through. And, you know, and Marion, when she's dealing with Art, she knows that Art is really trying to do everything right. And in a way, that bothers her. But she knows it shouldn't. She knows that Art's doing his very, very best, you know, to do, you know, what's right by the relationship and by her, and that he would do anything for her. And she's like, you know, why does that bother me so much? Because it does.
Yeah.
Again, I guess it's just human nature.
Well, it's 30 years of the same people living together in a small space and getting on each other's nerves a little bit, too. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, why do we desire the things that are sometimes bad for us?
Right.
That's that mystery at the heart of character there.
Yeah.
For Art, I think, you know, in wanting the guy to fall, I think is a little more, you know, he wants everyone to come down to his station.
Yeah,
I think at this point, because he's fallen, he's done the wrong thing. He hates things that are perfect because he knows that he's not,
mm-hmm.
Even though he tries so hard to be.
Mm-hmm.
So those things about themselves that bother the character, let those sort of crop up naturally in what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that I'm always dealing with characters who are terribly, terribly flawed and sort of more realistic than what we think of as the sympathetic hero of a novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think of, you know, heroes, you wouldn't think, oh, Art and Marion, those are heroes. You know, or Manny in you know, Last Night at the Lobster. You'd never think of this guy here as a hero, you know.
Yeah.
So it's that tendency for me to sort of undercut that idea of the Hollywood hero, the triumphal hero. Now, here are people in impossible situations trying to do their best and sometimes knowing that they're going to come up short and then having to come to terms with that. That's life, right?
And just being real people, just being human beings.
It's hard enough, right? It's hard enough just sort of like getting through the days and trying to do right by everybody.
Right.
That to me seemed the heroic effort of, was it Thoreau, you know, the Lives of Quiet Desperation? And here are people that are trying to do their best, and sometimes it's not good enough, just because of the situation that they're in. Now, you know, Steven Spielberg's never going to make a movie about that. But to me, that seems more important to write about. I mean, that's what I want the reader to focus on, rather than sort of like the massive, you know, the machinations of history or you know, the feel-good story. Or, mm-hmm. I don't know. That's just what you always have that choice as a writer, as what do you really think is important? What do you want the reader to focus on? And, you know, John Gardner said that if character is worthy of and capable of love, that the reader then will follow them anywhere. Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
Right. I was going to say, you know, Marion and Art aren't necessarily heroes when you start the book, but by the end, you're really rooting for them, and they do feel heroic, each in their own way, you know, trying to make this difficult situation better. So.
Well, and some readers will feel that. Other readers will say, oh, these two people are, you know, bland and kind of flawed, and why would I follow them? but, again, it's up to the reader, and you give the reader that choice. You don't enforce, you know, the character. You don't say, you have to root for the character.
Right.
You don't say, this character is good. This character is wonderful. You know, you need to root for them. You know, there's no swelling violins.
Right.
You know.
Which is why it will never be a Spielberg movie, but that's just as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Can I give a shout-out on the show? To Greg Bottoms, teaching there at the university.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
One of my favorite writers.
Great. Thank you for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me on, Sheila.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Stuart Onan. You can read more about his work at his website, stuart-onan.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Stuart Onan. While you're writing, be sure to remember all five senses. Often beginning writers approach their work very cinematically, relying heavily on visuals or occasionally something auditory. So while you work, be sure to think about texture, feel, taste, smell, as well as sights and sounds. Stuart Onan actually takes his hand, his five fingers, and slaps it to the top of his head from time to time while he's working to remind himself to think about the five senses as he works. He says that the flip side of this is do not just include the senses because you've come up with something interesting for the scene, not just because you've got a great smell or taste that you want to throw in there. Any detail that you do include, any sensory reaction, has got to impinge on your character's true desires. Otherwise, there's no need for it to be in the book. Selectivity is all, Stuart Onan says. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org. Every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.